from the North Carolina Reading Service. Hi, everyone. It's time for the Indie Week. John Feddersen with you, reading this program, which designed, as always, for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. And the issue this week, dated June 4 of 2026. And we have the usual assortment of some hard news, background news, a couple of features, and the first one, an article from Apex. The town council is considering election changes. Following suit with other towns in the Triangle, Apex is considering moving from odd-year mayoral and city council elections to even-year ones. An attractive prospect given the potential for nearly six-figure savings and increased voter turnout. If Apex makes the change, it would align the town's elections with county, state, and federal elections, allowing for cost sharing with the county, having the races all on one ballot, and reducing voters' trips to the polls. Apex is Wake County's third largest municipality, with a population of around 85,000. The town council passed a resolution in May the 28th meeting to explore the feasibility of switching to even-year elections and encourage other Wake County municipalities to do the same. Currently, the only Wake County municipality in the even-year boat is Raleigh. Though Apex council members seemed optimistic about the change, they made no formal decision and no vote was scheduled. When Raleigh made that even-year switch 2 years ago, it saw a 61% decrease in election spending, according to presentation that the Wake County Board of Elections Director Olivia McCall gave to the Apex council meeting. In 2019, the Wake County BOE charged Raleigh about $830,000 to run its municipal elections, and in 2024, that decreased from $834,000 to $325,000. Raleigh's voter turnout also jumped about 10%, said BOE Secretary Jerry Cohen. But in what could be seen as a trade-off, local races appear lower on a longer ballot after federal, state, and county races. A smaller township than Raleigh, Apex paid more than $150,000 for municipal elections in 25 and more than $200,000 in 23. If Apex saw the same 61% spending decrease as Raleigh did, switching to even years could look like saving nearly $100,000 compared to election spending in 25-26. Mayor pro tempore Terry Mahaffrey said at the meeting, "In a budget cycle where we're scrounging for every dollar, that starts to sound pretty appealing." By switching to even years, Apex would end up spending less because it would share election expenses, poll workers, equipment, sites, advertising, early voting, and ballots with Wake County, plus the more municipalities in Wake that hold even-year elections, the less expensive these elections would be due to this cost-sharing. Hence Apex's resolution urging other Wake towns to consider switching. Conversely, if more Wake municipalities switch to even-years, added Mahaffey, it becomes more expensive for towns to continue to hold odd-year elections, adding pressure to act relatively soon. But McCall told Apex's council she had not been invited to present to other Wake municipalities about switching these cycles, and the council members didn't seem too inclined to rush to make the change for the impending election in 2027. As of recently as 2010, only four municipalities in North Carolina held local elections during even years, said Cohen. As of 26, that number has grown to 75. He added that there are 12 other municipalities across the state intending to switch, with bills pending in the legislature. Durham City Council also recently heard a proposal to make the switch, but most City Council members seemed vehemently opposed to the move. During a May meeting, a council member voiced fears that local races would be overshadowed by larger elections. Multiple members also emphasized that odd-year locals allot time for voter registration and civic education, and for council members to campaign on behalf of higher office seekers. Well, how would Apex make the transition? Based on the potential for savings and a voter turnout spike alone, the move sounds like a no-brainer for Apex, but switching to even year would inevitably cause an awkward transition from one cycle to the next. Cohen told the council it would have to decide either to extend existing mayoral and council terms by 1 year, just once, or hold a one-time election for shorter 3-year terms and pay for elections in back-to-back years. Cohen said most municipalities opt for the former, and all 12 with pending bills are seeking to follow that method. That is, existing the council member terms by 1 year. This offshoot decision does present a potential conflict of interest. Council members could, with legislative approval, vote to extend their own terms by a year. Extending terms instead of holding an election that only produces 3-year term officials is, like making the switch to even years, in the spirit of cost effectiveness, but it also nixes constituents' ability to vote out ineffective officials for an additional year. That same extended term decision led to controversy in Raleigh when the mayor and council members chose, with legislative approval, to delay the 2021 election to 22 and continue with even years from then on, citing the COVID pandemic-driven census delays. In response to council members' concerns about constituents' pushback, Cohen noted the uproar in Raleigh was temporary. Per the council's resolution, Apex is issuing a survey to other Wake municipalities to gather their mayors' and council's feedback on exploring the switching to even-year elections. Town staff must now examine, quote, legal, operational, fiscal, and procedural implications of such a transition, unquote, and present a recommendation report to the council by June the 30th. If Apex wants to change to even-year elections, it would need state legislative approval. And Mahaffey said, the motivating factor here, we're in a budget season, and that's the reason we're discussing this. It does come down to money. And based on the data I'm seeing, it sounds like it's for everyone's benefit. Next, an in-depth article about Raleigh's affordable housing bonds. Its last bond built or preserved 2,500 units. How would the city spend $100 million more? This roughly $100 million affordable housing bond will be on the ballot this coming November after the Raleigh City Council approved the measure unanimously last week. The bond, expected to fund projects over the next 4 years, follows an $80 million affordable housing bond that voters approved in 2020. That money paid for the construction or preservation of nearly 2,500 affordable units over a 5-year period, some of which are still being built. It also helped the Raleigh City Council buy land for future affordable housing near major roads and public transport, including bus rapid transit routes, BRT. Finally, a chunk of money went toward programs to help first-time home buyers make down payments and long-time homeowners repair aging houses. With its new affordable housing bond referendum headed to the voters, we took a look at what the proposed bond would cover if approved and how the money from 2020 was spent. If approved, The 26 bond would continue to fund this construction and preservation of affordable housing, as well as the city's ongoing home buyer assistance and repair programs. This time, however, a portion of the money would also go toward creating a loan fund to help developers build mixed-income housing or a blend of income-restricted and market-rate units. For projects like this, the city expects about one-third of the units would be affordable. Housing and Community Development Director Amelia Sutton said during a March workshop. So for a 200-unit complex, 140 apartments would be rented at market rate and 60 would be rented at income-restricted rates. This one-time investment from the city would allow the loan fund to keep operating even after the bond expires, said Sutton. So even though each project might result in a relatively small number of affordable units, the city is getting a lot of bang for its buck. Sutton said, after one housing project is done and the developers pay back the loan, the city can use that money to make another loan and help another project. The fund would ensure construction of mixed-income housing continues steadily into the future, saying, quote, you're creating that forever fund. In the previous bond and in this one, developments that are 100% affordable are subsidized by the city year after year, Sutton added. The city council would also reserve a chunk of money to address homelessness, primarily by expanding a pilot program that has proven successful. The program, created in 2024, provided rent money to people for up to 2 years with the goal of housing them permanently. It also offered support services and case management to help people find jobs, for example. Council member at large Jonathan Lambert Melton told Indy, it's a no-questions-asked rental voucher, so folks cannot get discriminated against based on their source of income. It's just the ability to go and find an apartment and pay rent. As of July of 25, the city had enrolled 45 households. That's enough for an entire homeless encampment in the program. The program was so successful, with a relatively small amount of money, around $1 million, that Lambert Melton says he believes allocating more resources to it will be an ongoing city council priority. The supply of housing is mostly under the control of the private development industry. The bond would give the city more money to subsidize affordable housing projects, as well as help create stability by buying existing affordable properties. That would be in an effort to prevent rent hikes or redevelopment, and funding home repair programs. While the upcoming bond would still be a significant investment in affordable housing, it's less than the $200 million some activists were asking for. The City Council ultimately decided to put two bonds on the November ballot, $101 million for affordable housing and another $101 million for transportation projects. Parenthetically, the city has also dedicates a penny from the property tax rate to affordable housing, and that brings in about $11 million per year. The transportation bond would fund projects including BRT, which has been somewhat controversial in Southeast Raleigh. Some activists have said they believe the BRT line, that's Bus Rapid Transit, planned for New Bern Avenue will lead to gentrification and an increase in unaffordable housing. Lambert Melton told Indy, initially he was also in favor of a $200 million affordable housing bond, but after talking with staff and looking at data, he has changed his mind. Quote, there's only so many projects staff can get ready within the time frame that the bond money has to be spent. Giving them another $100 million is not going to result in substantially more affordable housing. He added that along with housing, transportation is one of the two highest costs residents are facing right now, and quote, if we don't focus on transportation, we're not looking at the problem holistically. Next, what did the 2020 bond accomplish? While that bond did help boost the supply of affordable housing, Raleigh is still facing a persistent shortage, especially for renters making less than $46,000. That's according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Some critics have said the city should focus on less on units affordable to people making as much 80% as the area median income, and more on housing that is affordable to people with the lowest incomes, but lower rents require a higher subsidy from the government. Lambert Melton notes the new bond would help residents earning these very low incomes through money that is dedicated to addressing homelessness. As of 2024, there was a deficit of some 70,000 units affordable to renters making 50% AMI or below. Population growth also continues to outpace housing development across the city, according to Raleigh's 2026-30 Affordable Housing Plan. About one quarter of units created or preserved by the 2020 bond, mostly apartments, but also some single-family homes, are reserved for people making 60% AMI or less. In Raleigh, that's currently around $55,000 for a single person and $63,000 for two people. Another quarter of those units are reserved for specific populations, including seniors, people experiencing or recovering from addiction, people exiting homelessness, and young adults aging out of foster care. One of the projects the city spent the most bond money on, $7 million, was Kings Ridge, a 100-unit apartment complex that offers housing and supportive services to people who have experienced homelessness, and it opened in January of 2025. Well, next, a very interesting article concerning Outlanders, Raleigh's self-governed homeless community. The camp is tucked in a patch of woods in South Raleigh near Interstate 40. Thick foliage camouflaging it from the road. To enter, follow the wide pathway flanked by fences made from discarded wooden pallets. Signs posted on tree trunks inform you that you're on camera and ask you to, quote, pitch in, put trash in its place. There's a fire pit, a picnic table, and a portable toilet. Strands of colored lights hang between the trees. Found objects and handmade decorations dot the campsite. A chipped garden statue, a custom metal signpost, pennants made from torn-up plastic bags tied on to blue twine. Individual campsites are tidy and personalized. They have heaters, generators, TVs, fans, microwaves, full-size beds, and pantries full of non-perishable food. Some residents live in clusters of tents. Others have built apartment-sized dwellings out of posts, tarps, and wood panels. At any given time, there are about a dozen people living here. Most of them are middle-aged. A handful are married couples. Newcomers and rule breakers live on the edge in a zone called receiving and non-compliance. Off to the side is an area called Veterans Ridge, home to two former service members. We chose to live this way, said Will Harris, who last year was elected mayor of Outlanders, believed to be the first self-governing homeless encampment in North Carolina. People have that misconception, he continues. You live out in the woods, you're either a drug addict or this and that. No, we're not. We're none of those. We chose to do this. Every Outlander has a different reason for being there. Some of them aspire to live in houses. Others, like Harris, would prefer to camp forever. Some of them have jobs, some don't. Some have a history of substance abuse or incarceration. Some are sick and disabled. many of the campers don't consider themselves homeless. After all, they have a safe place to sleep at night and neighbors who care about them. They're homesteaders, an intentional community. Maurice Folks, one of the newest residents, says, "I enjoy being out here. I love it." He's in his early 60s, tall and lanky, with a pencil mustache. He nicknamed his campsite, where he and his wife, Sean, have been living for about 7 months, Folks Frontier. They came here to find their footing after a hard time. The couple recently got out of prison, and Sean is in cancer recovery. And Folks said, "I want other people to know, don't be ashamed of living in a tent, because you're just in a different structure. We're in a vinyl structure instead of concrete or wood structure. Still, life as an outlander is not easy. The camp doesn't have running water. They shower and do laundry at Oak City Cares. Sleeping outside can be dangerous and uncomfortable. Some of the campers have to wake up at dawn to walk to work. People sometimes come from outside of the outlanders' camp to harass them. And underneath everything, there's a low, simmering anxiety that the refuge they built for themselves could be taken away. Standing atop a low hill near the middle of the camp, Harris can survey every corner. He said, "I have to look at everybody like they're chess pieces. Me and Karen are the king and queen, so now I need my knights. I need to put my pawns out where I need them." Harris and his wife, Karen, live in a structure of their own design that's bigger and sturdier than a tent, but less permanent than a house. Will is tall and bald. Karen is petite, with streaks of silver in her long, dark hair. They both have crinkly, expressive eyes. They share their home with their black cat, Midnight, their puppy, Leza, and the occasional overnight guest who needs a safe place to sleep. Will works full-time as a traffic controller for a construction crew, and Karen takes odd jobs through a temp agency. They lived together in the woods for about 2 years before moving to the Outlander site 7 years ago, and since then, they've slowly attracted a community of other people who are also looking for a safe, stable place to be. Well, before the group elected him mayor in September last year, Will was the de facto leader. He made the rules, basically. Keep your space clean and treat each other with respect, and enforce them. No one can join the group without his permission, and he's the one who decides if and when they graduate from receiving and noncompliance to the main site. He tapped his knights, his security team, from among the most established outlanders, and together they keep an eye out for intruders and noncompliant behavior that violates the community charter. That's a document which gave the community an official name and rules last year. Many, but not all, campers have signed the charter, which reads, quote, "We are a group of people living together, trying to survive and get back on our feet. To do that, we need peace, respect, safety, and a clean place to stay. These rules help make sure everyone is treated right and this camp stays strong. We're not camping, just camping. We're building something together. The Outlanders look after one another, not just because we're a family, but because we are working together to build a place where others can find hope, healing, and a future." Unquote. While nothing like this has existed in North Carolina previously, cities in other parts of the country are beginning to recognize self-governing encampments as a viable, empowering solution to homelessness. The oldest, most fully realized example is Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon, which formed in 2000 as a tent city under a bridge and now comprises tiny homes for 60 residents on a tract of publicly owned land. Because it's sanctioned by the city, Dignity Village has amenities the Outlanders don't, like running water, mail service, Wi-Fi, garbage and recycling pickup, and a dedicated social worker on the city's payroll. Villagers pay monthly dues of $100 for services, and they vote on big decisions. Over the years, the village has incubated several micro-businesses including a scrap metal recycling business, a firewood business, and a hot dog stand called Dignity Dogs. The median stay in Dignity Village is 1 year, and 80% of the villagers reportedly move into permanent housing. In its early days, Portland tried to squash Dignity Village. It was founded by a group of homeless activists who staged protests and parades around the city to call attention to the lack of available shelters. Each time they set up Camp Dignity, the police would come and decommission it. But they kept moving to new locations and reforming. They also started a 501c3 nonprofit and gave interviews to local media highlighting the injustice of being repeatedly displaced. Public support for the village grew, and in 2004, the city council agreed to rezone a piece of land as a campground so villagers could stay indefinitely. In Raleigh and wider Wake County, there are at least 1,200 unhoused people and only about 600 beds in the city's overnight shelters. But even if the shelters had more capacity, lots of people don't like or trust them. Penny, her pale green eyes narrowing in frustration, had this to say: "You're essentially in a minimum security prison." She and her husband, Johnny, learned about Outlanders less than a year ago when they were bouncing between shelters and budget motels. Some of the people in this story, including Penny and Johnny, asked to be identified by first names only for privacy. They found that camping with the Outlanders offered them a degree of freedom they'd been missing in the shelters, which are tightly controlled. "You can't bring in food or even a sealed plastic water bottle," Penny explained. "You can't bring most of your belongings into the shelter with you. Once you come in for the night, you can't step outside for fresh air. Many people avoid the shelters because they'd be separated from their pet or their partner. Many of Raleigh's shelters are gender segregated." Penny said, "If someone's angering you and you need to get away from them, you can't leave. And then they treat you like your inmates. They have jail orange bedding, jail orange blankets, jail orange towels, jail orange washcloths. It's like, you want us to be self-sufficient, but you won't let us be self-sufficient." That leaves hundreds of people sleeping in cars, on couches, in jails and hospitals and on the street every night. And being unsheltered makes every other dimension of life harder. If you're struggling with basics like shelter, hygiene, food and sleep, it's very hard to stay employed, maintain relationships, save money, and take care of your physical and mental health. Raleigh set a goal last year to reduce unsheltered homelessness to, quote, rare, brief, and non-recurring instances by 2030. Wake County has the same goal. Last year, Raleigh launched a pilot program aimed at getting unhoused people into permanent housing with providing them with rental assistance, case management, and peer support for up to 2 years. The first participants were 50 people who had been living in an encampment in Dorothea Dix Park. 6 months into that program, 90% of that group was housed, and the encampment was gone, according to the city. This summer, the Wake County Continuum of Care, that's the agency in charge of coordinating homeless services across local governments and nonprofits, plans to announce a surge to get more unsheltered people into housing using that same model. With $22 million, the agency believes it can, quote, effectively end unsheltered homelessness in 2 years, said their director, Eileen Rosa, to the city council. That's good news, but it might cause problems for the Outlanders, who, by the city and county's definitions, are chronically unsheltered. Their improvised version of case management, peer support, and transitional housing is not documented on any website or funded by any outside grant. The Outlanders inhabit a gray zone between sanctioned and unsanctioned. Technically, they are occupying public land without authorization. The city could decide tomorrow to decommission the camp and evict the residents. Yet Harris says police department and fire department know they're there, and no one has tried to kick them out. It's not like they're taking up prime real estate. The area is hilly, close to the highway, unlikely to be developed anytime soon. There are no houses or businesses nearby to complain. For now, their presence is tolerated. In response to questions from Indy, a Raleigh Police Department spokesperson wrote in an email, the department's approach to these encampments is to prioritize outreach, safety, and connection to services whenever possible, and the police do not independently initiate homeless encampment closures. Encampment closures tend to happen when the property owner has concerns about environmental impact, public safety, or repeated criminal activity, said the spokesperson. The Outlanders camp is peaceful and unobtrusive, with the recent exception of a stabbing in May. A man whom the Outlanders know and had previously reported to police for unpredictable, sometimes aggressive behavior came into the camp and attacked two people, one who sustained, who sustained non-life-threatening injuries. The attacker was arrested and is currently in jail. Harris says this was the first incident of its kind and does not represent the community norms he and other Outlanders are working hard to uphold. The police spokesperson wrote, before closing an encampment, the department's co-response unit, staffed by officers and social workers known as ACORNs, and partner outreach teams will, quote, attempt to conduct repeated outreach and engagement efforts, unquote, to connect residents with social services and let them know the area may be closed. The agencies, quote, work closely with city departments, property owners, and community partners to ensure the process is coordinated, informed, and as respectful as possible. To receive outside help, the Outlanders needed an official channel through which they could access Wake County's homeless support apparatus without overly exposing themselves and jeopardizing the tacit permission they've received from the city to continue existing. Enter Paul Geigel, an optician turned homeless service advocate and founder of a nonprofit Eliza Park Homeless Initiative, EPHI. Geigel met residents of this encampment in 24 while he was running a weekly food pantry and making an amateur documentary about homelessness in Raleigh. He befriended the group, particularly Harris, with whom he felt an instant kinship and asked what they needed. Though Raleigh does not officially recognize Outlanders as a community or a homeless service provider, EPHI is bringing the camp closer to the formal infrastructure it currently exists outside of. Geigel acts as a conduit between Outlanders, police, and the Wake Continuum of Care, especially in light of the recent stabbing. As another example, based on request from the Outlanders, Geigel came up with the Cash for Trash program, where participants clean up trash from the woods near Eliza Pool Park and sell the filled bags back to EPHI for $10 apiece. They don't have to register as employees or deal with employment documentation, and they get paid immediately in cash to clean up public spaces. In June of 25, Raleigh City Council member Christina Jones gave the nonprofit $8,000 in seed funding for this Cash for Trash program from the council's discretionary budget. In December, council member Jonathan Lambert Melton gave another $5,000 from that same discretionary pool. The nonprofit hosted its fourth and fifth Cash for Trash days in April and May. In April, 13 paid participants and 7 volunteers from the community filled 111 bags with over 3,000 pounds of trash and recycling in the course of a few hours. The nonprofit plans to continue holding these cleanups and collecting data in the hope of proving their concept to a longer-term funder. Geigel's group also provides weekly food assistance for the Outlanders and people in their orbit. On Sunday mornings, they bring a tower of cheese pizzas and bins full of donated non-perishables to the gazebo at Eliza Pool Park, gatherings that double as casual non-denominational church services, though Geigel stresses he did not impose a religious component, and participation is not required to access the food pantry. The group stands in a circle and passes a microphone around, sharing stories, prayers, and reflections. Penny shared on a recent Sunday, "I finally found a community I felt I knew I belonged to that would help me help myself, but also let me help them. I have yet to encounter somebody here I really don't like, which is kind of interesting because I'm not a people person. But at the same time, I want to help people." Geigel runs the nonprofit as a volunteer, but would like to expand. Both he and Harris have big plans for replicating their grassroots homelessness response model. When Harris began building what would become the Outlanders camp, he was doing it for Karen. He set it up to be as hippie as I could get it, according to her taste, so she'd feel comfortable inviting her adult children to visit. He strung up colored lights, rigged the ceiling of their home to be removable, so on warm, clear nights they could lie in bed and look up at the stars. Karen, though quieter and less authoritative than her husband, is a community leader in her own right, the spiritual, emotional kind. People tend to seek her out when they're struggling. She and the other women in the camp formed a group called the Crafty Divas, an informal peer support group with a side of arts and crafts. She's one of the people who helped make Outlanders into a true community. Harris tells a story about a homeless veteran named Bernie who had been living in the woods in Raleigh for more than 25 years. This winter, Bernie got an infection and ended up in the hospital with the amputated part of his foot. He was discharged in a wheelchair on the night of a January storm that coated Raleigh in snow and ice. He tried to check into a shelter but was turned away because it was full. Harris said he found Bernie wheeling himself down the road and brought him to the Outlanders. And he said the only reason he survived that snow was that me and Karen came up with a tent, hooked up electrical cords from our generator, and put a heater inside that tent. But Harris believes Outlanders offer a lot more than basic survival. He has seen the community restore people's sense of purpose and self. Take Penny and Johnny. They met in a mental health treatment facility, found each other again at Oak City Cares, that's a service hub for people experiencing homelessness, and are rebuilding their lives as Outlanders. Johnny said, "I got my dignity back. Truly, I have been blessed because we're in a community. We look out for each other. So many people out there, it's completely different. I feel sorry for them. But our circle, our organization, has tried to help and mend people that have been wounded." Penny has been unhoused off and on for about 18 years. She said, quote, "In a perfect world, I'd like to have a home with my husband and be able to just live. But at the same time, we already have that. I'm out here in a tent, but that doesn't mean I don't have a home. It doesn't mean I don't have a neighborhood, a community." Harris would like to expand Outlanders and invite more people to join. To do that, he'd need to reach an agreement with Raleigh or Wake County, similar to Dignity Village with Portland, to permanently and legally occupy a piece of land. It doesn't need to be their current spot in South Raleigh. In fact, Harris would prefer they move somewhere a little more remote where they could plant a vegetable garden and raise livestock. "It's overdue," Harris said. "These are citizens of the United States." What he's envisioning sounds a bit like farm-based therapy, a newish intervention model that exists all over the U.S., including right down the road in Pittsburgh. Harris's version would emphasize community, peer support, and shared responsibility. Riffing on it, Geigel envisions daily shuttles to work sites, tiny homes for residents, and a commercial campground nearby to create jobs and fund the whole endeavor. Convincing Wake County to let the Outlanders start a self-governed therapeutic community on public land feels like a tall order, one that would require funding, political will, and a maze of permissions. For now, Harris doesn't want to disrupt this fragile equilibrium the Outlanders have today. He's focused on tending to his work, his community, and his perfect view of the night sky, and he said, staying out in the middle of a storm while the trees and branches around you crack and you can look up at the heavens and seeing God being pissed, I love it. Ain't nothing like it. Well, many of these articles seem to be related in a loose way, at least saying, this one in Durham, the journey of a plastic bottle. Inside a concrete bay at Durham's Waste Disposal and Recycling Center on East Club Boulevard, a plastic water bottle lands with a dull crack against a pile of cardboard and glass, quickly swallowed into a growing heap of mixed material. Within minutes, a front end loader scoops it up and drops it into a steel trailer that will be hauled to a sorting facility over in Raleigh. If the bottle is clean and correctly sorted, it may be shredded, melted, and turned into fiber for clothing or carpeting. For many residents, that process goes on unseen, fueling a persistent doubt. Does recycling actually work, or is it all getting thrown away? The confusion starts with a lack of understanding of how Durham handles its waste. Muriel Willman, Senior Assistant Solid Waste Manager for Disposal, said, some people still think there's a landfill in Durham. There isn't. Durham's landfill closed in 1994, and the city has not landfilled its waste locally since then. Instead, it operates a transfer system in which both trash and recycling are collected curbside, brought to this Club Boulevard facility, and loaded into larger trailers for transport. Trash is sent to a landfill in Sampson County, while recycling is sent to a materials recovery facility in Raleigh, where it is sorted and sold. A single recycling truck may stop at 750 to 1,000 Durham homes on a typical route before returning to the waste center. At a transfer station, those smaller loads are combined into larger trailers that can carry up to 26 tons of material, with multiple shipments leaving the site every day for processing facilities outside Durham. At the Raleigh facility, the sorting process is both mechanical and manual. Materials are spread across conveyor belts separated by type. Magnets pull out steel cans. Electrical currents separate aluminum, and optical scanners identify plastics. Workers along the line removed contamination by hand. By the end of the process, the materials are compressed into bales, cardboard, paper, metal, and plastics, and sold to manufacturing. Willeman said, recycling is not small. It's a huge industry, and it employs 15,000 people in the private sector. But the system depends entirely on what residents put into their blue carts, and that's where it often breaks down. A common issue is wish cycling. That's a practice of putting items into recycling in the hope they will be sorted out later. In reality, items that don't belong are pulled off the line and discarded, often after traveling through that system at an additional cost. Willeman said, the thing is, if they have to sort it out and discard it, guess what? It has to come back here to go to the landfill. Plastic is one of the biggest sources of confusion. Many items carry the familiar triangle symbol with arrows, leading people to assume they are recyclable. In reality, that symbol identifies the type of plastic resin, not whether it can be processed locally. Of the seven common plastic types, only certain forms of number one and two plastics, typically bottles, jugs, and tubs, are consistently recyclable in Durham. Items like plastic utensils, styrofoam containers, and small plastic packaging are not accepted, either because they can't be sorted efficiently or because there's no market for them. Willeman said, forks are so small they're going to fall through the cracks. Plastic bags are another major problem. When they enter the system, they wrap around gears and conveyor belts slowing or stopping the sorting process entirely. They tangle the equipment. Contamination does more than disrupt operations, quote. There are workers at these plants, and it is a workplace health issue, a workplace safety issue. Food attracts germs, and it attracts vermin. Contamination also costs money. Durham pays to transport its recycling, pays fees when loads contain non-recyclable material, and pays again to landfill what cannot be processed. That cost has contributed to skepticism about whether recycling is worth the effort. But according to Willimon, the issue is not whether recycling works, it's whether the right materials are being collected. She said the markets are hungry. They are hungry for a clean commodity. Durham processes about 250,000 tons of municipal solid waste each year, compared with roughly 20,000 tons of recycling. Durham contracts with waste management to process its recycling in Raleigh, where materials are sold to companies across North Carolina and beyond. Plastic bottles may be sent to facilities like Unify in Winston-Salem, where they are turned into polyester fiber. Scrap metal sold to companies such as Omnisource, while electronics are sent to recyclers like Powerhouse. Each material stream has its own market, and those markets require consistency. Mixed or contaminated loads reduce the value of recyclables, and in some cases make them unusable. That matters as landfill space shrinks. The landfill Durham relies on in Sampson County has an estimated 20 years of capacity remaining, a timeline that could shorten with population growth or major storms. Beyond curbside pickup, the Durham facility handles a wide range of materials. Residents can drop off electronics, batteries, scrap metal, cooking oil, textiles for recycling or reuse, as well as hazardous materials like paint, chemicals, that must be handled separately. Most drivers entering the site first pass over a scale where they are charged by weight if their load includes trash or yard waste. If it consists entirely of accepted recyclable materials, like electronics, scrap metal, or textiles, drivers can bypass the scale and drop those items off at no charge. For workers at the facility, the system becomes clearer over time. Randy Goldston, a maintenance assistant, said, "There's so much stuff that can be recycled that I didn't know until I started working here. And then once they start breaking it down, it's amazing what they actually do with the recycling." He said, "One of the biggest challenges is awareness. It's like a whole bunch of people ain't got knowledge of it." For residents, the takeaway is less about doing more and more about doing it correctly. Keeping materials clean, avoiding plastic bags, and sticking to the short list of accepted items. "When in doubt, throw it out," said Willimon. "But I'd also say, when in doubt, check out the Waste Wizard online." Residents can also track their collection days through Durham Rollout, an app that shows pickup schedules, sends notifications, and includes a searchable waste database. Back in that transfer bay, another load arrives, spilling across the concrete floor as the loader moves into place again. The system keeps moving, steady and mechanical. What happens next depends on what shows up in the pile, a decision made much closer to home than many people think. "The list is short," said Willimon. "It doesn't have to be complicated." Well, let's get to a lighter cultural note, a new downtown Durham movie theater. About 300,000 people, maybe two dozen screens. That's the movie-going situation in Durham, where 17 of those screens carry mainstream fare at AMC South Point, and three of them focus on first-run indies at the Carolina Theater. You can eke out a few more by including the likes of Duke University's Griffith Film Theater or the former Full Frame Theater, now operated by Fullstream Brewery. Of the latter, Fullstream owner Sean Lilly Wilson told the Indy he hopes to open the brewery's new American Tobacco Campus location by Labor Day and wants to keep the small theater available as a local resource. In January, it hosted the Black Trans Short Film Festival with a screening by the Tipsy Durham Instagram account Two Beer Cinema Club coming up on June the 27th. It's a vital cinematic real estate now, the plentiful days of Durham multiplexes like Windsong, Willowdale, and Northgate are long gone, to say nothing of art house attrition everywhere. Jim Haverkamp, filmmaker, video editor, and Duke film professor, said, "It's like bowling alleys. Nobody's ever going to build a multiplex again." But Haverkamp and Alex Manis, a photographer and theater tech, are preparing to increase the local screen tally by one when they open Skin and Bones Theater downtown in just a few months. The new Micro Cinemas Curator Council includes Penelope Bartlett, formerly the Criterion Channel's Director of Programming, among other prestigious film jobs. Bartlett is also Creative Director of Film Durham, a nonprofit founded in 2024 that aims to become the hub of cinematic activity in the Bull City. Dedicated to cultivating local industry and talent, it has also started to program screenings and is long-range planning a festival. Though separately conceived, the theater and that nonprofit have strikingly aligned values. Both see cinema less as commercial content than as a vibrant form of city civic life. Both emphasize accessibility, inclusivity, and local identity over top-down curation from larger markets. Both want to hold spaces where all kinds of cinephiles and filmmakers can build a sustainable scene that fits an eclectic city like Durham. Elise Oxendine, Film Durham's executive director, said, "I give a lot of workshops about the future of film. My crystal ball says the future is going to be regional." She fell in love, Oxendine fell in love with classic cinema when she saw 12 Angry Men on TV as a preteen. "I was locked in. It was holding my attention. There's only one room. There's no action. There's no boom. All those crazy effects. But it was the story. It was the acting. I said, whatever this is, I want to do this." Soon she was directing the theatrical version at Durham School of the Arts. She went on to take film electives at Jordan High School, a year behind the Duffer brothers, and interned at Durham's Public Access TV. She explained Durham High Schools used to have specializations for each public school, and Jordan's was film and media. After graduating college, she built a career in marketing and distribution, working with the likes of the New York Film Festival and Rooftop Films. Now she's programs and industry manager at the Gotham Film and Media Institute, splitting her time between New York and Durham. After Bartlett moved to Durham in 2022, she and Oxendine soon became friends and started talking about how to channel their shared industry experience into something distinctly Durham. Oxendine said, "We wanted to start a film festival initially, but we realized we wanted to build a film community first. We saw firsthand how exclusionary a lot of festivals can be. When we're bringing films to Durham, we want to make sure it's accessible to everybody." Film Durham has put on 3 events so far. It started with a program of playful holiday shorts last December, projected on Main Street in collaboration with Downtown Durham, Inc. In February came a local black media panel on Parrish Street, that historic black Wall Street, where Nicole Oxendine, Elise's sister Long, kept her Empower Dance Studio. And in March, Film Durham brought noted film critic A.S. Hamra to Letters Community Bookshop. Oxendine said, "We want to have year-round programming that supports local filmmakers like a film society, but I don't want it to sound too buttoned up. I think what's going to be important for us is our access to actors and directors. We've seen this time and time again. If there's a Q&A with the director, or if it's a North Carolina premiere, there is a higher likelihood that people will attend." The goal is to build a film scene that doesn't just reflect Durham, but also benefits it. Film buffs remember when Wilmington was Hollywood East of the 2000s, thanks to the state's generous film industry tax credits. When those went away, so did the industry, much of it to Georgia. But today, the North Carolina Film and Entertainment Grant offers filmmakers significant rebates, and Oxendine sees an opportunity to build something lasting in Durham. The challenge is, she said, we don't want to end up like Georgia, where Hollywood brings their people with them. They contribute to the local economy, but for a short period of time. If we have our own indie ecosystem, it's really impactful. If people can not just shoot here, but also do post-production here, that adds to the economy in the state. Film Durham is eyeing a fall position for an annual festival. They hope to use their connections to bring in festival circuit fare curated for Durham and include some local programming too, but not this fall. Building trust takes time. Oxendine said, we want to bring actors and directors to experience the beauty that is Durham with an engaged, diverse audience. That's why our first priority is to cultivate our relationship with our audience. So when we launch our festival, it's not like, who are these people? There's a big push towards regionality in the industry, and there is a special place for that small theater, like Skin and Bones, where we can show interesting things. Approaching the end now of our issue, there are two articles that you can access going online to indieweek.com for free and looking them up, and with other articles and back issues as well. One was an op-ed about encouraging a vote against closing Glenwood Elementary School, and the other is incoming movies. But we have enough stuff about films for our audience. And so that's just a sample of the things that are still waiting for the inquiring consumer of news and information. And here comes our music, and here goes John Fetterson back into the vaults to emerge in the light of day, hopefully, and bring another issue of Indie Week to our listeners at the NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. This program will become a podcast after the Friday initial broadcast, like all of our podcasts do. And I hope you'll come to our website, ncreadingservice.org, and look into some of the many, 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 many publications that we read for you with pleasure and entertainment. Thanks for listening. So long.